Let's start out with telling us who you are.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bert Sachs, a former hardware and software engineer, 60 years old. Been described variously as everyone's favorite grandfather, a new image from the Seattle PI. I've been working as an activist to end the economic sanctions against Iraq for about 8 years, and I've made 8 visits to Iraq.
How did you get involved with the issues surrounding the people of Iraq?
About 8 years ago, I had to make a trip back to Boston, and I went to Harvard School of Public Health and tracked down a woman who was on what was called the Harvard Study Team, or the International Study Team, that went to Iraq in 91. The reason I did that was because in the summer of 91, there was a report in the Washington Post that had a big impact on me. One of the things it said was that this group had estimated that 170,000 children were going to die. And that shocked me. That was more children than the soldiers that the Pentagon claimed we killed, we slaughtered. I got the name of a woman who is Sarah Zaidi, who has worked with the UN for years, and called her up in New York, and she said, what's going on in Iraq then is still going on. She told me to read the New England Journal of Medicine, the issue from September 1992. And I went to the medical library at the University of Washington, got that out, and was stunned. It's a report that says 3 things. It says, because of the Gulf War deliberate bombing of Iraq's civilian infrastructure, most particularly electrical generating plants up and down the country, 2, there are epidemics of waterborne diseases, and 3, because of those diseases, the number of excess deaths of children under the age of 5 in Iraq totaled 46,900 children from January to August of 91. That's an amazing number. It's more children. It's about the same number of children as the Vietnam Veterans Wall of American soldiers. And these are under the age of 5. 5,862 kids every month on average. When that came out in 1992, it got almost no coverage. I went using LexisNexis and the top newspapers in the country and found only 5% of them had any significant coverage beyond either a small news clip or nothing, reporting on the deaths of 500,000 children, of 50,000 children. I just found myself jumping ahead of the story. Because we didn't pay any attention to that in 1992, the next major study of the maternal and child mortality in Iraq came from UNICEF. And it said, if the declining mortality rate that had existed in 1990 continued for the next 8 years, rather than the great increase in mortality that happened, there would be 500,000 children in Iraq under 5 who would be alive today. In that story, while it did get some coverage, the number of 500,000 children was largely missing from all the reports I've read. In fact, I can't think of a single newspaper where it was reported on the following day in the coverage. Not the New York Times, not the Seattle papers. And much worse than that, the Wall Street Journal covered that whole report in 2 sentences. It doesn't even appear in the index of the Wall Street Journal. The report of 500,000 children's deaths isn't even a news story. It's 2 sentences. The second sentence is even false. It's technically true. The second sentence says, the U.S. State Department or the U.S. government claims that these deaths are because the Iraqi government and Saddam Hussein withhold medicines and food from their people. I say that statement is not, it's true that the U.S. government says that, but that is the cause of the deaths is not true. All 3 of the UN heads of the Oil for Food program in Iraq deny this claim. And it's their job to oversee the program with 1,500 inspectors that monitor all the food and medicine coming in. It's almost as if it doesn't matter. The government in this country and in the UK continue to say whatever they want. And the media, by and large, continues to print what the government says without in any way checking, not from the government of Iraq, but from the United Nations that's running the program. That's kind of the history from 92 to 99 of a terrible human rights abuse going on in a country where we have been using, deliberately creating the conditions for and maintaining conditions that cause the death of thousands of children every month for the purpose of coercion. It's not only obvious from the facts, but we said we were doing that. In 1991, going back to that Washington Post article that affected me so much that I've saved, there are two quotes from U.S. Pentagon planners who were planning the bombing after the war. One of them is named, his name is Colonel John Warden. He said, "We bombed the infrastructure, the electrical plants, because it gave us, quote, long-term leverage on the government of Iraq," end quote. The other planner said, "People said that we didn't know what effect it would have on the water and sewage systems of Iraq. That's not true. We knew what effect. What were we trying to do with the sanctions? What we were doing by destroying civilian infrastructure was to accelerate the effect of the sanctions." End quote. If you can make those concepts real to yourself by reading the reports that are posted on our website or in a lot of places of people that have gone there and seen what is happening, what you see is children dying of diarrhea. You will see babies who have, you know, have died in incubators in hospitals because there's no electricity. You'll know there are patients that had to be taken out of hospitals because there's no electricity. Those are deliberate and known consequences of our policy. And I feel so passionately about this issue because it is so wrong for us to be trading off American soldiers' lives or American desire to control the oil of this country for the lives of children and citizens in that country. And we have been doing that for 12 years now. It's wrong.
You've traveled to Iraq 8 times.
Yes.
What was the motivation behind that?
Initially, in 96, when I made my first trip, it was to go see for myself. And see for myself meant look at the conditions that are there that you can see in the space of a week or 10 days. But one of the memorable events for me was to meet with the head of the World Food Program. We met in his office, and I wanted some quotes to bring back. And this was just literally a few days or weeks before the first oil began to flow under the Oil for Food Program. And he said to us, quote, "The Oil for Food Program will not solve the humanitarian crisis in Iraq." And I was still pretty new and naive to this issue. And despite the fact that we've heard that the Oil for Food Program is an expression of American concern for the people of Iraq, I've come to understand how it is not. It's evidence of the opposite. So let me give you the facts. In virtually all of the reporting about the Oil for Food deal, the numbers are quoted in terms of billions of dollars per 6 months. And the initial offering was $2 billion for every 180 days. Unless you have run immense human aid programs, you have no, and even then you need to know the basic statistics. You have no idea if that's adequate, excessive, or too little. But it's very simple to do the arithmetic. And the man who did that for us was, first in my experience, who actually gave me the numbers, was the second head of the Oil for Food Program, Hans von Sponeck. His talk in Baghdad to us in 99, to a Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility delegation, and then here in Seattle in 2001 in November, cite the numbers. And they're shocking when you hear them. Because if you take $2 billion a year, take out 30% at the time for war reparations, take out 13% for the Kurds, take out another several percent for running the whole UN program, including the weapons inspections program, and including the staff in New York for the UN Office of the Iraq Program. All of this is paid for by Iraq with their money. What you're left with is about 53% of that amount for all the people in the south and central part of Iraq. And that's about 20 million people. Then you take that number, divide by 20 million, and what you're left with is $120 a year per person for all the needs of each citizen. That means not just food and medicine, electricity, sewage, water, transportation, garbage collection, all the needs of a citizen are supposed to be paid out of $120 a year, 33 cents a day. Could you live on that? Nobody can. I hold that as prima facie evidence of our intention, the intention of the U.S. government, to maintain conditions of great suffering in Iraq, because all of the money coming from the All for Food program goes directly into a bank account in New York City. And no money can be taken out of that. Not one penny goes to the government of Iraq as money. Nothing can be taken out except in the form of contracts for humanitarian aid, for food, for medicine, for electrical needs. The question I asked the State Department when I called up several times is, what justification has there ever been for maintaining a limit on how much money Iraq can spend for their own civilian needs? And when I asked that question finally for somebody who was serious enough to give me a serious answer, I had the most satisfying 5 seconds of absolute silence that I've had. And finally he said, I don't know the answer. I wasn't here when that was done. There is no answer, and not an answer that's acceptable to the U.S. government. The answer is our intention to maintain conditions of suffering is a means of coercion. There is on the U.S. State Department website a document from 1999 which says sanctions have never been intended to harm the people of Iraq. That is why food and medicine have always been exempted from the sanctions. End quote. Not true. I have against me a $10,000 fine because I have admitted to one violation of our sanctions law, bringing medicines to Iraq. You can read the regulations of the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control. You may not bring medicine or anything of value to Iraq without their license. Everything is sanctioned. That's an example of the great kind of misinformation which floods all of us as citizens of the country, and which I claim is evidence of how badly our democracy is at risk. I say that because everyone recognizes that you can't have a democracy unless you have informed citizens. In other words, you could vote all you want, you could have elections every month, but if you don't know the facts, the essential key truths about what you're voting on, then it doesn't make any difference. And it can't be just a marginalized sliver of the population that knows. It has to be essentially everybody, or essentially available to the population. So to come back to that report, for example, of 500,000 deaths of children from UNICEF, when that report came out on August 12, 1999, friends went and surveyed the transcripts of the three commercial television networks for the following 60 days. And there is not one mention of the UNICEF report. So if you got your news by watching the nightly news on the three networks, you would never know about 500,000 children's deaths. And worse than that, one of the networks took the time to do a comical story from Baghdad about people there having to sell their watches because of the conditions of impoverishment in that country. I mean, if you surveyed 60 days worth of reporting on the network news, it's impossible to believe that there wasn't time to do a story about 500,000 children's deaths. That's how badly informed we are. I don't want this to be taken as a generalization that all of the media is failing to behave responsibly. That's not true. And I'd like to cite a couple examples here in Seattle so people will know and appreciate. In 1999, the Seattle PI sent their foreign editor, Larry Johnson, and staff photographer Dan DeLong to Iraq with us. And they did a wonderful 8-page special report that's been reproduced 3 or 4 times to something like 20,000 copies now. We distributed it to everybody in Congress with the help of Representative Nethercutt and Senator Murray. That has been both one of the best things done about Iraq in the media and an example for other papers. So the Hartford Current and other papers have sent reporters to do something similar. On the other side, the Seattle Times has done a series of 5 or 6 excellent editorials that are linked on our website that people ought to go read because they are some of the best in the country. And that website is www.endiraqsanctions.org. Those are the good things that our local media has done. And there are other papers like the Chicago Tribune that's been good. But even here with the local media, the same papers have not done good, responsible reporting, I would say. On the news side, where the Seattle Times has failed in many opportunities to report the statistics that we can make available to them that are there and well known, and instead covered the story the way the wire services cover it, simply taking the wire service that says something like sanctions cause suffering of the Iraqi people, or even worse, Saddam Hussein claims that they cause suffering, instead of reporting that sanctions are contributing to the deaths of thousands of children and cite the numbers. That's a failing, and it contributes to the death of those children because the readers of the Seattle Times don't know that, don't know the facts. On the other side, the PI has failed to meet with the 4 times we have brought Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck to town, former UN heads of the Oil for Food program, and has done, sadly, a rather misinformed editorial that we're able to respond to with a very fine op-ed piece by Kate Flaumer, former U.S. federal attorney here. So it's a struggle, but it's an essential struggle, I think, to have the media behave more correctly. And one way is to work directly with the mainstream media. Another is through something that I support very much, which is independent media, whether it's the indie media organization or whether it's public access TV or whether it's publications that come out. Like Real Change, for example, did a cover story about Iraq a few months ago. And that was fine. We educated, 18,000 people, I think, was the circulation of Real Change. Good for them. Good for Adam Holdorf. Good for the paper. So we have to work to keep getting the story out.
You mentioned earlier that you're facing a potential fine from the U.S. government. When did the U.S. government start pursuing actions against you? How did you find that out?
Mm-hmm. In 1997, I went to Iraq with a delegation from a group called Voices in the Wilderness, based in Chicago, that has been one of the outstanding groups in the country working on this issue. And there were 4 of us, Reverend Randall Mullins, Dan Handelman, Randall lives here in Seattle, Dan Handelman from Portland, and Joe Zito, who used to live in Tacoma at the time. 4 of us went to Iraq. We took with us about $40,000 of donated medicines. When we came back through customs, landing in Detroit, the customs people took us aside, confiscated from us videotapes, film, notebooks, and 2 small presents that Randall had brought for his children, and asked for statements from us. They were, in one respect, with me at least, they took us individually, very good. They told me I had no obligation to say anything to them. If I wanted to, they actually had a form that talked about Cuba and bringing stuff to Cuba, and they crossed out Cuba and wrote Iraq and said, "What are you willing to tell us?" And I said, "The one thing I'm willing to tell you is that I have brought medicines to Iraq. That's the only violation that I admit to. If you want to know anything more, send me a letter. I'll bring it to my lawyer." So they were helpful also getting us on the airplane to get back here, and when we got back to Seattle, the story had got out, and we had, I think, both newspapers and all the TV stations covering us at midnight when we came back into Seattle. That was 1997 in December, and it took a year before we heard anything else. And in 1998, the four of us and Kathy Kelly for Voices in the Wilderness received what's called a pre-penalty notice, and that threatened fines of about $10,000, $12,000 on each of the four of us and $120,000 on Voices in the Wilderness for the crimes, and there were six or eight or ten different counts in the letter described. The ones listed against Voices were the crime of bringing medicine on different occasions to Iraq. Very clear. The letter is also posted on our website, which is endiraqsanctions.org. If anybody doubts that it's a crime to bring medicines to Iraq, read what the Treasury Department's letter says to us. It's a total of $80,000 in fines for that crime of bringing medicines. We all replied, and one of the very good replies came from the professor of international law, I think is his title. His name is Richard Falk, and his addendum to our letter, his statement, is also online on our site, where all of this correspondence is available. Richard Falk points out the great human suffering and death that's been occurring in Iraq as a consequence of sanctions policy, and argues that we have a right to bring medicines without having to ask for our government's approval, which is fundamentally the position all of us take. Under what conditions would it be justifiable for our government to say, no, you cannot bring medicines to help save lives? And in what possible way can bringing antibiotics and cough medicines threaten American national security? I think the opposite is clearly true, that by denying those medicines, we create great anger and understandable bitterness, frustration towards the American government's policy. Okay. 1998 went by, and then we had all responded and heard nothing. And from 98 until I got back on my very last trip, which was the end of May, nothing. And suddenly I got a letter from the Treasury Department saying, I have 30 days to write a check for $10,000 payable to the U.S. Treasury, it said. And I just learned yesterday that Reverend Randall Mullins received a letter for the same amount. So there are now two of us in the country. As far as we know, we are the first people and the only one so far who have been fined for our travel to Iraq, and essentially for the reason we go, which is to bring medicines. And there's another interesting point, and for bringing information back. And the letter to us, go read it, makes clear that the U.S. government holds it's a crime, it's a violation of U.S. Treasury law, to bring videotape from Jordan into Iraq, to take pictures, and then to export that same videotape that we didn't buy in Iraq back out of the country of Iraq. In other words, to bring intellectual property, to bring information, to bring the interview with the people that we meet with back to this country. And the federal government confiscated those videotapes, and it took 2 years in the ACLU action against the government to get those tapes and notebooks even back. And Dan Handelman pursued that with good tenacity, and he got it back. But that's what our Treasury Department and the Office of Foreign Assets Control is doing. And the information I want Americans to realize is it's a crime to bring medicines to Iraq by our law. And even if you get a license, you can't send them through the U.S. mails. You can go to any post office and have that confirmed. Ask if you can send cancer drugs to Iraq to anybody. You'll be told no. And I have a friend who sent cancer drugs to his sister, and they came back to him in a week's time. And his sister has died from cancer. That's what we are doing. So those are the reasons why I'm proud to say I will not pay the fine to my government, because I hold that I have not only a right to do these things, but I have an obligation. And we have not only American professors of law, such as George Bisharat, whose article called "Sanctions Are Genocide," posted on our website, printed in the Seattle PI, and a 45-page article published in a law magazine of his just recently. But the UN Subcommission on Human Rights itself has a document also on our site that was a news story, which the working committee of the Subcommission for Human Rights says this, says, quote, "Economic sanctions against Iraq are unequivocally illegal under international humanitarian law. Some would argue they may even be genocide," end quote. Lawyers saying that we may be committing genocide against a whole country where a million people have died? And what are we doing? And what kind of misinformation and deliberate lies is our government telling us to cover up this great tragedy? And are we as Americans willing to look at the truth of this, which I contend has convinced me in 8 years of study of what I'm saying? Or are we willing to say, well, it's comfortable for us, it's convenient to us to believe whatever our government tells us, no matter how thin that story keeps wearing out? And each individual will have to make that choice in their own life. And it's a very important choice. It's important, obviously, for the people of Iraq. It's very important for our own country. And it's very important for every individual who makes it, because it's a choice to make a commitment to knowing the truth, no matter where it goes, or not. And on that point, I agree and like very much Mahatma Gandhi's statement that there are many ways of worshiping God. Now, I worship him only as truth. So what that means is, if you, in your life, in any of the multiple decisions that we all make every day, in all the small and large details of our life, if we go towards the truth, if you're like, we're going towards the spirit, towards, if you like, God, or towards the divine, or towards the good. And if we don't, if we say, I don't want to know that, I don't want to know what's true here, because it might make me uncomfortable, I might have to do something, then you see we're going away from the good. We're going away from spirit. And we will feel ourselves devoid of that which gives life its value.
Since the fine was levied against you, the media has been picking up this story, it appears, so far. What's been the public reaction to the stories that people have heard?
I would say overwhelmingly, for me, it has been exceedingly heartening. I have got emails and letters, even phone calls from people that have looked me up in the phone book. I'm in the phone book, the only Bert Sachs in Seattle. And people I don't know at all, who just read the story in the Seattle PI, or people in Australia who saw it on Common Dreams website, or who read our press release from the Institute for Public Accuracy, with a great quote by Howard Zinn at the beginning. People have heard about this and wanted to lend their support. The fact that there's so many people from around the country and around the world, actually, Australia and the UK and Geneva and where else? Canada, for sure, and around the country, have bothered to take the time to send me an email saying I support you. And most of them people I don't know at all. We, in response to the fine, decided to take an action. And the action we've offered to people, trying to be creative and make the point that we need to make, have issued a declaration called Declaration 2002. And what it asks is for 1,000 people to each give $10, not to pay the fine, but to buy another $10,000 worth of medicines, which we intend to send back to Iraq without asking our government's approval. Everyone that does that, if they wish to put their name on it, will be doing it in the same way that we do, as a clear statement that we hold our government does not have authority to tell us when we may send medicines to save lives. And the response to that has been also overwhelmingly positive. The Voices office has gotten about 50 letters a day in just the first week of this action, So we're already at probably now over 300 names. And we've already reached the level of $10,000 in donations. Some people have given hundreds, and there's a man from Seattle who's given $2,000. So you hear those stories and you feel, yes, there is out there what we so often don't have any sense of from the media. People who will hear a story and will be touched by it and will say, I have to do something. This is enough is enough for me. This is a chance for me to take some action, and I will. And it may be sending $10 anonymously, or it may be sending $2,000 with their name. And that gives me a lot of heart to see that happening. The fact that we've reached the limit does not mean that people shouldn't take the action. I encourage everyone, both because I think we'll do this more than once. I think that we may send the medicines, we may, it's not clear yet, in August, and we may do it again in the fall. And secondly, I agree also with one of my examples and heroes of how to do this kind of work, Mahatma Gandhi, who said, it may seem very insignificant what you do, but that you do it is very significant. It's very important for you to do it, whatever actions you take. So the way to find out about this is, again, to go to our website, ndirocksanctions.org, and right at the top you'll see a story about the fine and what you can do, and click there and you'll go right to the Declaration 2002. Or if you want to go to the Voices website, that's www.vitw.org.